escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These. Have a special treat this week. I'll be talking to Carol Anderson. She's a professor at Emory University and a true friend of the pod. She's the author of, among other things, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, as well as One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Now she's going to talk to us about her new book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. It's a heavy topic, for sure. But I think you'll be surprised by how energetic and engaging she is. I am jealous of her students, for sure. So, coming right up, Carol Anderson talking about The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America.
Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, having you back. This is the second time we've had you. It's lovely to have you back.
Thank you. And it is great to be back.
So I guess my first question for you is a really broad one, but I'm so curious. Just how did you get interested in the subject of the Second Amendment and as it applies to anti-Blackness?
You know, my research, the bulk of my research has been about African Americans' rights. Their civil rights, their human rights, their citizenship rights. And it was with the killing of Philando Castile in Minnesota. And here you had a Black man who had been pulled over by the police. And following NRA guidelines, he alerts the officer that he has a license to carry weapon with him. And the police officer begins shooting and kills Philando Castile. So Castile wasn't brandishing the weapon. He wasn't threatening to use it. He was just alerting the officer that he had one, so the officer wouldn't be surprised when Philando reached for his ID and saw the gun. And he was just gunned down in front of his fiance and in front of her small child. And the NRA went virtually silent on this. I mean, virtually silent. And the NRA doesn't do silence. But there they were when a Black man is killed for simply having a license to carry weapon, virtual silence. And journalists were asking, well, don't African Americans have Second Amendment rights? And I went, ooh, that is one I haven't explored yet. And because in our current environment, the Second Amendment right is seen as foundational for citizenship. I thought, oh, this would be a really good one to explore. And it sent me hurtling all the way back to the 17th century.
You know, so when I, you know, looked at the title of your book and started reading it, this idea of the Second Amendment and how it intersects with anti-Blackness, I thought I kind of knew what you might mean because I'm familiar with, for instance, you know, the gun laws in California having targeted the Black Panthers, right? And I'm familiar with how any law that that interferes with any kind of right is always disproportionately applied to Black and brown people. So I have no question that the way the gun laws are applied here disproportionately affect Black and brown people. But what your book does is it shows how the creation of the Second Amendment, like from the beginning, from before there was a Second Amendment, was infused with anti-Blackness.
Yes. And that was my aha moment in this work, in this research, was seeing how fearful white colonists were of Black people and how they kept creating the architecture of control, the slave patrols that went into the slave cabins to look for weapons, to look for books, the militia that was there to quell massive slave revolts, to keep Black people from being able to fight for their freedom. And the gun laws, the laws that said that the enslaved as well as free Blacks could not have access to weapons. That kind of fear was just pulsing through. And what I also saw was, again, I go back to your previous question of how we think about the Second Amendment now. Part of the way we think about it now is this kind of hallowed ground of the militia as being this incredible force that fought against the British and fought for American liberty and American democracy. Mm-hmm. And wow. And
spoiler alert for people that haven't read the book, militias, not so great after all, right?
Not so great after all, right? So you have this thing where George Washington is just beside himself because sometimes the militia would show up, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they show up and then they'd stop fighting and then they take off running. I mean, it's like, how can you have a battle plan when you cannot rely upon your forces to be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there? And so they could not rely upon the militia to take on a professional army.
Yeah, let's just stop for a second. And I want people to drill down on this a bit, because we do have this, especially, I think, you know, white Americans have this idea like, oh, the noble colonists who rebelled, so brave, you know, took up arms against the British. And that's why we're free today. Again, not so much. Right.
Not so much.
They had trouble rounding up the necessary numbers of white people they would need to fight the British.
And
because the idea of arming Black people was already, again, pre-Bill of Rights, pre-revolution, but in the, you know, height of slavery, this idea, you said it in the same breath, books and guns, same kind of weapons in the eyes of white people. So the idea of having, you know, Black people help fight the Revolutionary War, which they needed to do in order to have the numbers, was just resisted so heavily.
Oh, I mean, so in 1775, they banned Black people from joining the Continental Army, just banned them. But the British are kicking some USDA grade A prime beef butt, and they can't get enough white men to enlist in the Continental Army. I mean, they are so far below their quota standards for what they need to take on the most powerful fighting force out there. And so finally, in 2 years later, they relent. So you start seeing in the North where they're like, okay, fine, we are going to let enslaved men join the Continental Army, and we're going to promise them their freedom for being able to fight in this army, for being willing to fight in this army. And so you had Black men joining the Continental Army and it became a fully integrated army. Mm. So you didn't have Black units and white units. You had a fully integrated army, and they fought. There were like 5,000 Black men in this army. Mm. And it was so incredible, so strong, so powerful, so effective that the British were like, dang, let's go. You know, but with a British accent, I can't do dang.
I won't make you. We'll just say, I liked it better in your accent. Dang. Let's just say dang.
And that'll work.
And that's especially interesting because the British were already abolitionists, right? Like,
well, the British were moving toward abolitionism.
Right.
And one of the things that you saw happening in this war that freaked the colonists out was that the Earl of Dunmore, who was the royal governor of Virginia, had promised the enslaved men who were on the plantations of the rebels that come fight for the king and you will be free.
Right.
And,
so this raises a question. What would be the deciding factor there? I mean, it seems like if you're an enslaved person, the British are there, they haven't enslaved you, right? And the Americans are there, and you and yours would not be in the colonies were it not for them enslaving your family. So when you choose who to fight for, what can you talk about that a little bit? Because there's a part of me that feels like why would they trust the Continental Army to let them have their freedom after they fought?
It's a great question. and really, this was, you see how powerful the quest for freedom is among the enslaved, that they're like, who's going to offer us our freedom? How do we get free? Because you had a series of revolts, slave revolts prior to the Revolutionary War. You had had Black folks fleeing, going into maroon territories where they were setting up their own communities that were in the swamplands to be almost impenetrable to whites so that they could be free. And so this pronouncement from the Earl of Dunmore was like music, music, and tens of thousands fled to the British.
And we can't blame them. I mean, like, again, as much as the founding myth of America is a part of my upbringing as anyone's, that seems like a pretty easy piece of calculus to make, right? I mean,
And you had folks like Benjamin Franklin going, wow, they're getting ready to turn our Negroes against us.
Well, who did what there, really? You know, who turned them, I would say.
and it's this kind of framing, because that framing also is what would continue to feed into the anti-Blackness, that Black people could not be trusted, that, you know, they got the slightest little wink and nod from the British and whoo, they took off running in our hour of dire need. But during that war, what you saw were that the Black men who fought in the Continental Army, they had a lower AWOL rate than whites. And they fought for longer periods of time than white men. So, but all of that got erased. And it was just, look at all those Black folks fleeing. See, you can't trust them. They're untrustworthy. They're no good. They're dangerous. They're fighting against us.
For one thing, I also want to acknowledge the bravery of anyone who's going to choose to try to escape enslavement and go to fight for the British. It's not just they made a choice. Am I going to stay here or go fight for them? It's an incredibly risky choice to say, I'm going to take this incredible risk. Cause it's not just like who am I going to fight for? You know, decisions, right? It's making this incredibly dangerous choice.
Absolutely. The precarity of Black life is for me, one of the salient points that courses through this book, that Black folks would continue to fight for their freedom, would continue to fight for democracy, would continue to fight for justice. But in that fight, how they fought and what they fought for made them absolutely vulnerable to the violence that would rain down on them, the state violence that would rain down on them, the state sanctioned violence that would rain down on them. The precarity of Black life courses through this book because it courses through American history.
So all those thousands of enslaved people who chose to join the British were already taking their lives into their own hands, as it were. I mean, finally being able to take their lives in their own hands rather than someone else's hands. But this incredibly dangerous choice to even try to escape to go fight for the British. What incredible bravery there. And then let's talk about the Black people that fought for the Continental Army, because damn it, Carol, I don't know. I mean, I assume there have been some writings or narratives from these people. where we get some kind of insight into the choices that they made?
You know, and, you know, it's, there is a precariousness there. And so I'm going to go to the point after the war.
Okay.
Where, you know, so they were offered their freedom for fighting.
Right.
But then you get a court case in Virginia in the early 1800s that says, yeah, whatever. If they're Black, there is an automatic assumption that they are enslaved and they have to prove otherwise. So think about that. You have fought for this nation's freedom and you still have to prove that you are not enslaved.
Well, and that's the story that continues on through today.
You have to prove. Yeah, you have to prove that you are not dangerous. You have to prove that you did not provoke the violence that came raining down on you.
Right.
Because as Black is the default threat in American society, that is what has helped feed this sense of precarity, the reality of the precarity of Black life.
I'm going to just try one more time with this choice. Okay, so the colonies could not have won the revolution without the Black people that fought on their side.
Absolutely.
And there was no reason for the people who made the choice to fight with the white soldiers of the Continental Army. I mean, I feel like to call it a leap of faith is not enough, right? I'm curious, like I said, I'm curious, like to decide to do that rather than either do nothing, you know, I mean, that's a choice. It's a valid choice because again, every choice that a Black person made at this point in time is in precarity, right? Like there's no safe choice. To escape is dangerous. To stay is dangerous. To fight for the Continental Army is dangerous. So those that fought for the Continental Army, do we know why?
There was a sense that they could be free.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sense of the language of democracy, mm-hmm. the language of a new kind of regime that, you know, we hold these truths. There was this sense of freedom. Freedom mm-hmm. is a powerful elixir. And the sense that the people who had once held you in bondage, held you and your family in bondage, were saying, Lord, we need you now. Huh. God, we need you now. We need you now so desperately that if you come fight for us, you will be free.
Carol, that gives me chills.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, that has been the promise and the fight for so long. If you fight in this army for democracy, for American values, you will be free. And what we know from Black men in the military up for a long, long, long span of time, that was not true.
And that's the thing that gives me, like, I have a physical reaction to that. The bravery to take that chance,
mm-hmm.
That expression of the highest ideals that the revolution was supposedly fought for, right?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, so one of the things that I continue to argue is that our freedom struggles have been on that aspirational plane mm. of what the United States says it is. Not what it actually is, but what it says it is. And that is where you have seen these incredible freedom struggles of people fighting to gain access to those aspirations, to that democracy, to that freedom, to that equality, to that justice.
It's one of the arguments of the 1619 Project, that it's people of color, Black people especially, that have kept America honest, as it were, or tried to, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Woo,
tried. That's the other thing that breaks my heart, to hear you articulate this powerful belief that these formerly enslaved people had, they bought our bullshit, speaking as a white person, right? Like, they believed what we were telling them because on some level it's true, right? And then to have it, as you said, like right after the war, a court case finds you're a slave until you prove you're not. And then after the First World War, those veterans are lynched and tortured and subjugated. And then after the Second World War.
And then after
Vietnam. I mean, like, it's just this, and we can argue about whether or not the Vietnam was necessarily fought to uphold American values, but this idea that we will, and let's get to the real point of your book, right? The Second Amendment, we will take up arms. We, the people who were brought to this land in chattel slavery, we will take up the guns that you have given us. We will fight for you. We will not turn them on you.
Right.
At least not right now, because you've told us we need to do this. And they keep coming. It keeps coming back to that. It keeps coming back to that.
Right. And the we will take up arms. And so part of what we also see in this is the exigencies, so that when whites need Black folks to bear arms, then there is a loosening in that boundary, so that during the Revolutionary War, and you couldn't get enough white men to enlist in the Continental Army, and the British are like coming. I mean, the British are coming, and there's this sense when you think about this, the Americans were traitors to the British crown, and we know what happens to traitors. So this is the, oh my God, we can't get enough white men. What are we going to do? And it's, and when you think about it as well, in South Carolina, when the war stiffened up north and the British said, we're going to hit the soft underbelly, we're going to go south. And so they send basically a doggone near armada of 8,000 troops to the south. They hit Georgia collapsed like that. General Howe was like, I don't even know what happened. And then the British were like, we just whooped your butt. That's what happened. And now they're going to head toward South Carolina. They're coming to Charleston. And George Washington sends his emissary, John Lawrence, a prominent son of South Carolina, to beg the South Carolina government to arm the enslaved, because South Carolina had deployed the vast bulk of its white men to control its enslaved population as part of the militia. Right?
Yes, the militia.
And there were only 750 available white men to take on this mass force coming from the British of 8,000 troops, only 750 white men available. And John Lawrence is like, you don't have enough white men to stop that. So you've got to arm the enslaved. And the response from the South Carolina government was, we are horrified that you would ask us to do something like that. This is alarming. This is appalling. And we don't even know if this is a nation worth fighting for.
See, so this gets to the question that came to me fairly quickly as I was reading the first part of your book. With friends like that, do enslaved people need enemies? What I mean there is, I'm just going to, this, we know how the story ends, right? Eventually, the enslaved people are armed. Eventually, we win. Eventually, you and I are here speaking with American accents as fellow citizens of the United States. When I heard the vitriol expressed by Southern colonists still, right, about arming enslaved people, when I heard, even, I mean, you know, Northerners were not racist, right? I mean, they were still pretty racist. And then at the same time, you have the British saying, come on over, you know, we're not going to keep you, we're not going to enslave you. And it was so close, right? They were, the America was on the colonies were on the edge of losing this whole thing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I have to ask the counterfactual. What do you think it might have been like for Black people if let's say the South Carolinians were just so far up their own asses, they couldn't see it straight to have some help fighting the British, and the British had won?
That is an incredible counterfactual.
I know, but I have to ask. I know it's not necessarily useful, but...
You know, and I think it would have been something akin to Jamaica, where you would still have British rule and you would have the lure of the profits that come from these vast plantations. And you would have the language that would justify it via racial hierarchy.
So what I hear you saying is anti-Blackness is a hell of a drug and that it's going to win out a lot. So it's not necessarily to say, so yes, the Americans were pretty horrible. British were pretty horrible. British for a second there seem less horrible. But this language and these ideas that are bubbling up in the colonies. I mean, there is a reason why the enslaved people chose to go ahead and fight against the British.
That language was powerful, and we really see the power of that language with the Haitian Revolution.
I was going to ask you to tell us about the contagion of liberty.
Yes, yes.
So why don't you tell us about the Haitian Revolution and the contagion of liberty?
And so the Haitian Revolution began in 1791. And remember, you had the French Revolution. Haiti was a French colony. And the French Revolution began in 1789. And you had King Louis the 16th, who was beheaded and deposed in that. And so you had this battle happening in Haiti over who would control this incredibly rich colony. You had a battle between whites and mulattoes, and you had a vast Black enslaved population. And so while the whites and mulattoes are battling each other, the enslaved looked up and said, oh, we're getting ready to get free. And they took it. In 1791, they brought it. Toussaint Louverture and the Haitians rose up and just started fighting for their freedom and to get rid of that colonial structure that had imposed an incredible brutality on the Haitians. And they had talked in these revolutionary terms of equality and fraternity, so equality, brotherhood, but what they also brought that what in liberty, but what they also brought was a sense of racial equality, something that wasn't just about the kind of civil liberties that the U.S. talked about, but in fact, a racial equality. They made that central to how they envisioned freedom because it had been racial oppression that had kept them down. And they fought. And I mean, so they took on the Spanish because the Spanish came up in there and the Haitians were like, son, you don't know my name. You don't want some of this. and so then the British rolled up and they're going, but you know, we're the British. And they were like, no, you would be dead. That would be your name. And so the British talked about it was like fighting for a cemetery with the number of dead Brits because of how the Haitians fought. And so then Napoleon rolled up in there and he was like, oh, I got this. And he came in with, you know, he brought, he sent his brother-in-law and with a fleet and like tens of thousands of French troops. And the key was guerrilla warfare, where you don't try to meet this army one-on-one. Instead, you hit them, you destroy their means for existence. So a scorched earth policy, And then they said, we wait for the rains, because with the rains comes yellow fever. And the fighting and the yellow fever just destroyed the French troops. They lost, they had an 80% casualty rate.
Oh my God. Wow.
So, yes. So the Napoleon had to just go, okay, uncle, you win. You win. And so you begin to think about what this means. Haiti is not that far from the United States. And so having a successful slave revolt where they have fended off and destroyed three European armies, it upends that whole sense of white supremacy, that whites are absolutely invincible and that Black people are docile and are subject and are here for subjugation, here for nothing but labor. They're not here for freedom. And so the ideas coming out of Haiti are just, you know, George Washington called them lamentable to see Blacks in this state of revolt. And Thomas Jefferson was like, oh, Lord, Lord, they're coming. They're coming. We have got to keep this kind of evil from getting over here.
And the irony, or I don't know if it's called, right, called irony, but there's this echo chamber of revolutionary ideas basically happening, right? Because
yes.
The Haitian Revolution built upon the ideas of the French Revolution and the American Revolution, right? And then that echoes back into the U.S. and white people are scared shitless. Like,
oh my God.
You started it, guys. But
and they were like, yeah, they were like, okay, the wrong people are getting these ideas. These ideas have a whites only sign on top of them. I don't know what made you think you could be free.
Right.
I don't know what made you think that this was available to you.
And it's at this point in the book where I studied American history. Okay. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, but I studied it, in America. So I did not know this, which is that you can make an argument, and you do make this argument in the book, that the Bill of Rights itself, which, of course, written around the same time as the Haitian Revolution, right? They're sort of going on at the same time there. In some ways was designed to put that whites up only sign, right?
Yeah, I really look at that with the Second Amendment.
Yeah, the Second Amendment specifically, like in a weird way, not so weird because you're going to explain it, but it was what we think of as this, you know, sacred, you know, list wouldn't exist if it weren't for the South demanding some kind of carve out, right?
Like, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we had the Articles of Confederation coming after or coming during the war for independence. And then that those Articles of Confederation were like the governing rules when the U.S. won. But the Articles of Confederation were just that. Mm-hmm. It was a confederation. And so each state was acting like its own little thing with its own money, its own foreign policy, tariffs between their borders. Stuff wasn't working. Mm. The thing was getting ready to collapse. And so there's a group that gets together to revise the Articles of Confederation. And James Madison is like, nah, this thing isn't revisable. We need to start from scratch. And they join together and they get into Philadelphia and they start drafting this constitution that has a much stronger central government. One of the things that Madison does is he puts control of the militia under the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that because of the weakness that the militia showed during the war. Because he's like, okay, they need some real serious training.
We can't have you turning tail on us. We need to to smack you around a bit, get you under control. You can't just go off to your farms, you know, when things get tough. So we'll take control. And again, for people that are following current Second Amendment debates, this is kind of an important thing to know. Right?
It really is. I mean, this is the piece that gets obliterated, right? Is that the role of the militia was that militia turn tail. That militia, even when they were winning, like at Bunker Hill, couldn't close the deal because the folks who were fighting just were like, okay, I'm tired of fighting. And they were going home. And the group of militia men that were supposed to replace them were like, no, I'm not doing that. So so Madison puts control of the militia under the federal control, under the federal government.
Right.
And when it's time for ratification, then ratification is moving along. And then it stalls like in New Hampshire. And Virginia hasn't signed on either. And Virginia is one of the big states. And so Washington sends Madison down to his home state of Virginia to get into that constitutional ratification convention. And he runs into the buzzsaw of the anti-federalist of Patrick Henry and George Mason.
Mm.
And they start laying into him. They are like, this militia thing. Now, you know good and doggone well that the North detests slavery. How dare you put control of the militia, which is our only defense against a massive slave revolt. How dare you put that under the federal government that includes like folks from Pennsylvania and Massachusetts? You know that they would not call in the militia to protect us against a slave revolt. We will be left defenseless.
I just sort of have to fast forward to the current debates about what people who believe that the Second Amendment is about individual gun rights say. This is such a no, it's not. It's like, because what there's, and also this veneration of the militia, right? Like, which again is sort of built up. And I don't think it's just like outright racists who say this. It's sort of just part of the culture of the history that we are kind of absorbed into, mm-hmm. is that our brave militias fought for freedom. Mm-hmm. And indeed today, mm-hmm. the reason why we have a right to a well-regulated militia is in case those some assholes come and try to take our liberty. Not all right. Wrong.
but this was the other component in that, is that right before the Constitutional Convention, there was Shays' Rebellion.
Right.
And Shays' Rebellion was in 1787, and you had a group of white men who were angry at Massachusetts taxation policy. And they decided to basically attack the Massachusetts government. Mm. And they were taking over courthouses because there was seizure of land for non-payment of taxes. And so the way that you stop that mess is that you take over the mechanisms of the law that allow for that seizure. So they're taking over the courthouses, and then they're going after the armory in Springfield so they can get more weapons to really bring it. And so the Massachusetts government is like, help, help, and calls in, you know, so the Massachusetts government tries to call in the militia to put down Shays' Rebellion. And the militia are like, nah, I'm not doing that. And you actually have some militia men who actually go and fight with Shays'
right.
forces.
Right.
And so Boston merchants have to hire a mercenary army of 4,000 men to put down Shays' Rebellion. That thing is what is hanging over the head. I mean, it is there like Banquo's ghost. It is this really daunting shadow as they're writing this language about the militia. The militia is not reliable. And when it, yeah.
Except when they're there to
boom,
go after 4 million enslaved people. Like,
oh, drop militia, that mic.
The militia is not reliable in the place where we're sort of kind of, you know, in a very propagandistic way taught to believe that they're reliable, which is, you know, mm-hmm. stand up against oppression. They're incredibly reliable on the side of oppression.
Oh, my. Oh, my. They are there. So it was Stono's Rebellion in 1739 in South Carolina, where you had Black folks rise up and try to get to Spanish Florida because there wasn't slavery in Spanish Florida. And the South Carolina militia was like, oh, no, the last thing we need is Black folks thinking they can just go south and get free. And they hunted them down. And their militia laws, for instance, required men, white men, to carry guns at all times. And so Stono's Rebellion happened on a Sunday. So these white men were in church with their guns, and the alarm started ringing that, oh, the slaves are fighting. The slaves are in revolt. And these white men got their guns that they had right there with them and took off to hunt those who were fighting for their own freedom.
I would like to revise and extend my remarks, by the way, about militia and when they're reliable.
Okay.
They're reliable when they're fighting to oppress Black people specifically, because the Shays Rebellion thing is about white people, right? Militia not so reliable. And we don't care, right? That's the militia response to Shays Rebellion. You know what? Government schmovergant, you know? But then when is a militia really reliable? Right here.
Right here. Right there. Right there. We see that consistently, how the militia is called upon and how responsive the militias are to slave revolts. They are there. My mother used to say, Johnny on the spot. Mm-hmm. They are there. And so you have George Mason talking about, and recall that during the war, the North was trying to get us to arm our slaves. And so, you know, we can't rely upon them. You know, we have to have the militia to be able to put down these revolts. And there had been a series of revolts in Virginia before the big ones that we often think about, mm-hmm. which is Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner. There had been a series of these revolts prior to the Constitutional Convention.
So, Carol, I'm going to pause us on this cliffhanger, and we're going to take a short break. With Friends Like These is brought to you by Beta Brand. Now, there are a lot of good things about, you know, normality, going back to work, going outside. You get to see people. You get to eat in a restaurant. But you also have to wear pants. Unless you're wearing Beta Brand's dress yoga pants. They're pants, but not real pants. They're yoga pants. They're stylish and polished, but with the comfort of your favorite loungewear. Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants are designed with the fit and flexibility of yoga pants, but they look like professional dress pants. They're so amazingly soft and stretchy and absolutely effortless. You can just throw on a pair, add a cute top, and you are set with style and comfort for the rest of your day. There are tons of different styles to choose from: straight leg, skinny, cropped, bootleg, and even more. And colors from classic black to fun prints like houndstooth, or as they call it, cat's tooth. They have a print that's sort of like houndstooth, except it's little tiny cat heads. That is not the one that I got. I got a cool, like, bright colored window pane plaid. Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants are perfect for whatever you need to get done that day. Whether you're sitting at a desk for 8 hours, though please stand every 20 minutes or so, working with kids and bending and kneeling all day, or maybe you're a photographer and you need to squat to get that perfect shot. Whatever the case, you're going to look good and feel great doing it. The pants are made of wrinkle-resistant stretch knit fabric. They look great all day and travel amazing. Plus, they're machine washable and don't need to be ironed. And they have pockets. We are talking comfort and function. No more fake pockets that are sewn shut. These pants are designed for real women who need real pockets. New colors, patterns, and styles are coming out all the time. Be sure to keep an eye out for limited time new releases. They do sell out fast. While you're there, make sure to check out Beta Brand's ultra-flattering tops, skirts, dresses, and more. The dress pant yoga pants are just the tip of the iceberg. Right now, our listeners can get 30% off their Beta Brand orders when you go to betabrand.com/WFLT. That's Beta Brand, BETABRAND.com/WFLT for 30% off your order for a limited time. And when you use our special URL, you are telling them you support our show too. Please tell them you support our show. Find out why women are ditching typical work pants for Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants. Go to betabrand.com/WFLT for 30% off. That's betabrand.com/WFLT. With Friends Like These is brought to you by Magic Spoon. We all love breakfast for dinner. Maybe you, like me, love breakfast any time of the day. What's great about it is it kind of starts your day over. But you don't always want to start your day over with a really heavy meal of, like, bacon and eggs. So you know what? Turn to Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon is delicious. It helps you start your day over, and it's good for you. 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net carbs per serving, only 140 calories per serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. You can build your own box or get a variety pack with the available flavors of cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and cinnamon, and cookies and cream and maple waffle. Those were special edition flavors that are now back permanently. I like to mix my Magic Spoon cereals, and I think you should try cinnamon and maple waffle together. Yum. You can get all of these flavors at magicspoon.com/WFLT, and be sure to use our promo code WFLT at checkout to save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's back with a 100% happiness guarantee. If you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/WFLT and use code WFLT to save $5 off. And thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. With Friends Like These is brought to you by BetterHelp. What interferes with your happiness? You know, something interferes with my happiness on a pretty much daily basis. But also, you know, I go through stuff and everyone goes through stuff. So I personally believe that everyone should have a therapist. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can connect in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you will begin communicating in under 24 hours. It's not self-help, it's professional counseling. Send a message to your counselor anytime and you will get a thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. The service is available worldwide, and it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, though financial aid is available. There's a broad range of expertise which may not be available to you in your area. Licensed professional counselors specialize in depression, anger, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, and trauma. Anything you share is confidential. You can check out the testimonials posted daily on their site. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/friends. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, betterhelp.com/friends.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
In case people have forgotten, we are at the exciting debate over the ratification of the Constitution. And Madison has introduced this idea of the militia being a part of the federal government, correct?
Yes, it's already in the draft Constitution. Yes. Okay.
The South is not happy because they know, or they suspect, that those darn freedom-loving Northerners would not help them put down a slave rebellion if they were called upon to do so, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They were afraid of that.
They were afraid of that. So where are we? So what is the twist here? What happens?
And so what happens is that George Mason starts pounding on the issue of having a Bill of Rights put in the Constitution, these amendments that could curtail the power of the federal government and that would protect basically the militia. And so when you think about, and they were very clear that if they didn't get that, that what they would do is that they would push really hard for a new constitutional convention. And what Madison was afraid of is that this would be Pandora's box, and it would hurdle the United States right back to the unworkable years of the Articles of Confederation. Mm. And so he's wants to make sure that he's got this Bill of Rights there. And what he knows from the battles over the in the Constitutional Convention itself was that the South will play some serious hardball with the being of the United States, with the foundation of the United States, the existence of the United States.
You know what? He wasn't so wrong to be afraid of that. I mean, a few years, you know, 100 years later,
boom, right? Right?
He's not wrong to be worried.
He was not wrong to be worried at all. I mean, he smelled it. He smelled it. So, I mean, this was they wanted to get the three-fifths clause in order to get representation in government, because the South was afraid that it didn't have enough people when it came to the House of Representatives, you know, where you count the number of that they didn't have enough people, and they would always be outvoted in the federal system. And so they demanded that the enslaved be counted on a full equality with whites, which led Elbridge Gerry to say, excuse me, I thought you said they were property. So if they're on full equality with whites, they're citizens, right? And they can vote. Why don't you give them the right to vote? And they were like, no, that's not what we said. And then another delegate said, excuse me? So then you count them for your state representation, right? And they're like, no. They're like, so if you don't count them for the state, how on earth are you going to count them for the federal? And they said, let me tell you what, we don't get this. We don't at least get three-fifths.
We walk. Yeah.
Ugh. Madison was used to the hard ball that the South would play. And so when George Mason was like, and Patrick Henry, who hated James Madison from the depths and the breadth and the heights that his soul shall reach, hated him some James Madison. Mm. And Madison knew it. He was like, they will scuttle the United States of America. They will call up a new constitutional convention. I've got to get this Bill of Rights through the first Congress and get it ratified. And so Madison goes up to that first Congress, and he's drafting these amendments because they're pouring in from all of the different states, and he's condensing them. And when you think about them, we end up with the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right to not have a state-sponsored religion, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right to a speedy and fair trial, the right not to have cruel and unusual punishment, the right to a well-regulated militia.
It's so weird when you put it that way, Carol.
Right? For the security of a free state? What?
Yeah.
What?
One of these things is not like the other, I feel like.
Yeah, one of these things is not like the other. This is the bribe to the South, to the Southern anti-federalists, to mollify them so that they are comfortable enough with the Constitution, comfortable enough with the protections of slavery, so that they won't scuttle the United States of America.
It's basically, we're going to enumerate all these rights for the first time in history, which is kind of cool, right? Mm-hmm. That are natural rights, such as the natural rights of what they think of as man, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to express yourself. These are all, again, sort of this language of God-given. And then you get to militia.
Right? Right?
Which isn't such a natural right. Like, it's, you know, you aren't born with a militia. There specifically. So yes. We're going to list all these rights that we believe are available to everyone under God. And then also, hey, South, we're going to give you the right to beat the shit out of anyone you want.
Right. And so sitting here in our Bill of Rights is the right to control and contain and destroy the rights of Black people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing I thought about as you unpack this in your book is sort of, again, to flash to the current debates over the Second Amendment, a lot of them are about, is it intended to be about militia? Is this about arming a militia, or is it about arming an individual, right?
Right.
All these debates, all these legal scholarship about that. And I know you're not claiming to be the utmost, you know, legal scholar here, but to follow the history of your argument, mm-hmm. it seems like it's intentionally unclear, right? That it's, they're not trying to make it for sure, oh, this is definitely about a well-regulated militia, or this is definitely about an individual right to bear arms. They're saying, like, yeah, whatever you need to do, South, like, just here, like, whatever you need this Second Amendment to be, we're going to let you do it.
Yeah, and see, I read that more as to be able to arm individual men to be able to be in a well-regulated militia.
Right.
And so I think about Madison's initial draft of the Second Amendment, what we call the Second Amendment now, where he's like, unless you have a conscientious objection to bearing arms, then you don't have to be in this well-regulated militia.
See, and that's also kind of a mind fuck too, right? That's not the way we think about it. Like,
right.
They were carving out, the initial idea was to carve out the right to not participate.
Right. Exactly. 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 And then when the Senate committee got a hold of it, they're like, nah, get rid of this conscientious objection stuff.
Right.
Because what they were also afraid of is that you had this argument. You had a couple of arguments going on. One is that this conscientious objection thing that would lead the North to say everybody's a conscientious objector to this. And so the South would be left defenseless.
Uh-huh.
They're like, uh-uh. And you also had during, and I'm going back again, during the Virginia ratification debates, you had, I can't remember if it was George Mason or Patrick Henry arguing that what would happen is just what we saw happening in the war for the Revolutionary War, was that these Black men would be enlisted in the army and being given their freedom. And they said, could you imagine under a federal structure that would control the militia, they would bring all Black men into the military and they would get their freedom. That is absolutely objectionable. Yeah.
With Friends Like These is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When it comes to looking for a job, most people would agree that the whole thing is not fun. In fact, here are some things I'd rather do than look for a job. Bake in the Texas heat. Figure out a tech issue with my computer. Eat dry, salty crackers in that Texas heat with no water around. Or maybe unclog a sink drain. But it doesn't have to be this way. ZipRecruiter gets it. They've actually figured out how to make the job search process better and easier. When you sign up at ZipRecruiter.com/easy, you can create a free profile. Then you get matched to great jobs and a lot more. ZipRecruiter will proactively pitch your profile to employers whose jobs match your experience. Unlike with other job sites, if an actual person from the company really likes what they see, they can personally invite you to apply for that job. Candidates who are invited to apply on ZipRecruiter are nearly three times as likely to get hired. This is according to over 10,000 logged ZipRecruiter users who report being hired through ZipRecruiter in September and October of 2020. Plus, if you like that job you're matched to, you can apply to it and many others with just one click. It's that easy. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job site in the U.S. So what are you waiting for? If you want an easier job search, sign up for free right now on ZipRecruiter.com/easy. Once again, go to ZipRecruiter.com/easy today to sign up absolutely free and put ZipRecruiter to work for you. With Friends Like These is brought to you by Monk Pack. Let's face it, most healthy snacks don't taste very good, they don't fill you up, and they don't satisfy your cravings.
Our sponsor, Monk Pack, makes snacks that satisfy a sweet tooth, but with 1 gram of sugar or less. Monk Pack keto nut and seed bars have just 1 gram of sugar, just 2 to 3 grams of net carbs, and they're only 150 calories. They're the perfect snack for anyone trying to eat healthier or cut back on sugar and carbs without sacrificing taste. They're great after a workout for a job well done, or I take them hiking and, you know, just eat them when I'm hungry. Monk Pack keto nut and seed bars are the perfect balance of sweet and salty, crunchy from nuts and seeds, but still soft and chewy. You can get them in tasty flavors like sea salt dark chocolate, caramel sea salt, and peanut butter dark chocolate. You may have noticed all the ones I read have saltiness to them. Those are my favorites. They're keto-friendly, gluten-free, plant-based, and non-GMO with no soy, trans fat, sugar, alcohols, or artificial colors. Now, you should get a subscription to make sure you don't run out of your favorite flavors. It saves you 10% on every order and ships automatically. Try them for yourself and see. We have a special deal for our listeners. Get 20% off your first purchase with any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering code WFLT at checkout. Monk Pack is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to monkpack.com. That's monkpack, M-U-N-K-P-A-C-K.com, and select any product. Then enter code WFLT to save 20% at checkout off your purchase. Monk Pack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on. We thank them for sponsoring this podcast. Hi. If you're enjoying With Friends Like These, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll really like, 70 Million, an investigative documentary podcast from LWC Studios. Did you know there are 70 million Americans with criminal records? Not me. Also, I didn't know there was something called offender-funded justice. That's when legal systems are largely funded by fines levied against people who are arrested even before they're tried. Through 70 Million's deeply reported episodes, we can gain a deeper understanding of our country's intertwined legal systems. Now, so far, over 3 seasons, the Peabody-nominated narrative series has chronicled how remarkable people around the U.S. have transformed legal systems and entire communities in the process. In season 4, 70 Million will look at how police, jails, and prisons have become the catch-all for unattended social problems and forgotten populations. It will tackle the big questions we must answer as a society about who we are and who we pretend to be when it comes to achieving liberty and justice for all. Season 4 launches on September 13th. Take a listen and subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcast. For more, visit 70millionpod.com. That's 70millionpod.com.
Carol, well, you and I have talked for almost an hour and we've gotten all the way up to almost the 1800s. So...
Well, we had to get the foundation
And of course, we can crowdfund our like 10 episode podcast series on each decade in American history as it applies to the Bill of Rights and anti-blackness. But I'm going to have to fast forward us just a little bit.
Definitely.
So the first place that I have, as far as like, I think we might want to stop our time machine, is in Oakland, California. With Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton. They're driving along. They have some shotguns with them, as I recall. Tell us about the when this is and what happens.
So this is in Oakland, California in 1967. And what has happened is that the Oakland police have just been brutalizing the Black community. Brutalizing that Black community, beating up folk, shooting folk, and there's no accountability in the system, none. And so the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense arises out of this sense of the lack of accountability. And Huey P. Newton is a law student, and he knows the law about open carry. And he's like, we are getting ready to police the police. And so they figure out what kinds of guns they can actually have, how they have to carry those guns, how those guns have to be loaded. And they know also how far away they have to stand from the police when the police are making an arrest. And they are policing the police. They are standing there open carrying with their guns. And the police are not liking this at all.
Oh, I recall they have some things to say, don't they? Aren't they yelling some things as well?
Oh, the cops are just like, what makes you think you got a right to a damn gun? What do you do with these MF guns? And it's like, man, these are my guns. I know the damn law. And just start spewing California code at the cops.
Spitting code. They're spitting code.
Right? And the cops are like, damn. And so they run to Don Mulford, who is a conservative assemblyman in the California legislature, and say, look, we need your help with these Black Panthers. Every time we pull them over, they're legally carrying. You know, they've got these 45s, they've got these shotguns, but they're not sawed off shotguns. And the way that they're openly carrying them, it does not violate the law. They're legal. How do we make them illegal? We need your help. Mm. And Mulford's like, yeah, I'm there. And starts right and starts writing the law. And he gets help from an NRA representative in crafting this law that bans open carry in California. And you've got Ronald Reagan as governor of California writing, I'm eagerly awaiting this piece of legislation to hit my desk. I will eagerly sign it. So, you know, we often think of this kind of constellation of the conservatives of being pro-gun, except when you've got Black folks carrying guns like the Panthers, they're like, oh, no, we're not having that. Mm-hmm. We are not having that. And when you think about it, the genesis for this was the massive police brutality raining down on the Black community. But you didn't see any kind of legislation coming up in there about how to rein in the cops and to make the cops accountable for that violence, for that extraordinary, extraneous violence. Instead, it was, how do we stop the Black Panthers?
It is, I believe, always a good rule of thumb in American history to when you see a restrictive law, ask, who are they trying to oppress? Right?
Yes.
In almost every restrictive law there is, from laws regarding sex work to drug laws to licensing of hair salons, as much as I'm a commie pinko simp and I love government, I really do. But you have to look at all of our history through that lens, I think, you know, or at least ask that question. And your book pointed out something that I hadn't thought about before, because, again, I'm happy to have the government regulate stuff. That seems like a good idea to me most of the time. But if I remember the story of the Black Panthers and I remember the story of the Bill of Rights, and then I think about gun laws, and I think even a law like not allowing felons to own firearms— Carol, I'm embarrassed to say I've never really thought about that as being an anti-Black law. But guess what? When you decide felons can't own firearms, who are you saying can't own firearms?
Particularly when we have criminalized Blackness.
Yes, all those other things that we've regulated and criminalized. Yeah.
Right. When we have criminalized Blackness, that then makes the felons can't bear arms, an anti-Black provision. Mm-hmm. It is a way of making that disproportionately Black. And this is what we see happening. And so the power of these laws is that they are often coded in this language of safety and security. This is what we're bringing, safety and security to the American people. Look how we're protecting you. Mm-hmm. And what we're actually seeing is, look at how we're protecting you from Black people, because Black people are the threat. Black people are who are dangerous in this society. Look how we are protecting you from them.
Mm-hmm. And also you point out laws against guns in public housing is another law that winds up being de facto anti-Black.
Absolutely. I mean, and this was the thing, is about seeing the ways that these laws worked, and seeing then who is disproportionately affected by them. One of the other laws that I looked at, as you can tell, I moved us all the way up into the 21st century.
Yeah.
So to go from the 1600s to the 21st century. Ooh.
Our podcast series that's just about every decade is going to have to be longer than 10 episodes. So we'll just have to come back around on that. I'll write up a treatment. I'll get back to you. But yes, bring us up to the 21st century.
Is that, you know, so you think about the law and stand your ground.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is a law that is supposedly one of the hallmarks of the Second Amendment, the right to self-defense. And what has happened with this law is that what it does is it expands the castle doctrine. The castle doctrine is when it says somebody who comes into your home, an intruder, you have the right to defend yourself, to expel that intruder, to neutralize that threat. The stand your ground says anywhere where you have a right to be.
Hmm.
Ooh. And if you perceive a threat, you have the right to defend yourself. Well, you know, so if I'm at the grocery store, if I'm in a parking lot, if I'm at church, if I'm at work, places where I have a right to be, and I perceive a threat. Well, when Black is the default threat in this society,
mm-hmm.
This is why we're seeing the kind of disproportionate. What I mean by disproportionate, when whites kill Blacks under stand your ground, they are 10 times more likely to walk under justifiable homicide than when Blacks kill whites. 10 times more likely under stand your ground.
Mm-hmm.
When whites kill Blacks under stand your ground, they have a 281% chance of, they're 281% more likely to walk under justifiable homicide than when whites kill whites.
Mm.
When Blacks are the victims of this violence, because they are seen as the threat, it makes it justifiable.
I want to stand up and turn around and look back at all that history that we somewhat fast-forwarded over.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important I want us to land somewhere that I think that you do bring us to in the book, which is the recognition of the incredible resilience, grace, and fortitude of Black people in America, and how hard they've fought for this country and the ideas of this country, even when admit they were fighting the country. You recount story after story after story, all these stories. Again, I thought I knew some American history. These stories of revolts and uprisings, just mm-hmm. from before we were a country up until everyone remembers a year ago, and of course since then too. Black people have taken their rights seriously and fought for them whenever it's
yes.
whenever necessary.
Yes. Yes. I've got to say, this was a hard book to write because I was writing it in the midst of the pandemic and in the midst of a wave of police killings of Black people and in the midst of the assault on our voting rights. And so seeing all of this work that Black people had done to fight for this democracy, to make it live up to its ideas, to make its aspirations real, and all of the terror and the bloodshed. You know, so in this book, you see, I'm talking about Red Summer of 1919, and like in Elaine, Arkansas, where you have Black folks who were sharecroppers and who had their wages stolen from them. And so they had the audacity to try to organize a labor union, to join a union. And for that, and the white landowners found out about it and sent a scouting party up there to disrupt the meeting, to break it up. And the Black folks said, if white folks find out about this, they're going to kill us. And so they had set sentries out in front of the church where they were organizing. And there was an exchange of gunfire as that scouting party came up. And a white man was killed and another white man was wounded. And the word got back, Black folks are trying to kill all of the white people here in Elaine, Arkansas. They're trying to kill all of the white people here in Phillips County. No, they're trying to get paid for their labor. And they're trying to defend themselves against violence. It got so intense that they called in, the governor called in the U.S. Army that brought in machine guns that had been used in the war in France and began machine gunning down Black people.
And yet.
Yes, and yet.
Again, grace, resilience, fortitude. To keep fighting. And again, I thought I knew about the slave rebellions and uprisings that had happened in America, but clearly you tell so many stories than I knew, and I bet there are even more stories. There are stories we don't know, because the stories of the uprisings aren't good for history. They're not good for us. Me speaking as a white person.
Right. And I think that this is part of the reason why we're seeing that incredible backlash against the 1619 Project, and that and the way that it gets cast as critical race theory. And I'm like, you are not teaching kindergartners critical race theory. I guarantee it. but it is, when they say we want a patriotic history, that means that you've got these flattened two-dimensional heroic figures who are just making great decisions all the time. Well, their humanity and their humanness is stripped from them. We don't see them in their full embodied selves, making good decisions and bad decisions and dealing with the consequences of those decisions. If we don't have Patrick Henry and George Mason talking about we will be left defenseless, we don't have that Second Amendment in there. That is talking about the right to a well-regulated militia for the security of a free state.
I think some people, maybe even good, well-meaning white people, get itchy when we call something that used to be called a riot an uprising. This book really helped me understand why we do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something I said a little bit ago, which is that what I see in this book is a history of Black people fighting for the ideals of America, even when it means fighting America. Right?
Yes.
Standing up for the rights that we white people have always taken for granted and saying, no, these are ours, even when it means taking up arms against fellow Americans. That sounds maybe rough. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to put this in the best way I know how.
No, it is. And so this has been also part of the strategies of how do we fight. And so one of the reasons why I think the civil rights movement ends up on its iconic status, mm-hmm. besides it being like incredibly awesome.
Well, yeah.
is because it went after that narrative of Black people as being inherently dangerous and violent and criminal by deploying that nonviolent strategy.
Right.
And allowing the cameras, that new technology of television, to be able to show the violence of Jim Crow, to physically see the violence of Jim Crow, that it wasn't just these laws that were eviscerating, creating civic death in Black folk, but it was the way that it created a violent death as well.
Mm-hmm.
And to see, so when you see white people beating up Black folks who aren't swinging back, then it was like, it was like cognitive dissonance, a national cognitive dissonance. This isn't making sense. Whites are law abiding. They're freedom loving. And Black people are the dangerous ones. And so the image that we were seeing in the civil rights movement, just flip that upside down. And that's why the Panthers then became so, they became what the J. Edgar Hoover called the most dangerous organization in American society. Basically public enemy number one were the Black Panthers, because you had Black men and Black women carrying guns, mm-hmm. and being unequivocal about their rights.
Which again, if it was Clive and Bundy, right?
Mm.
Like, it's okay. See, that's why, I mean, I get weird about saying like they fight for their rights. You know, Black people fought for their rights even when it fights against other Americans. Because I don't want to play into this idea that Black people are dangerous or Black people aren't, whatever. But I feel like we, in popular culture, lionizes white people who stand up against the government.
Right. Think about the insurrection on January 6th.
Oh, well, yes. Speaking of. Ooh. Yeah, sure.
Ooh.
I mean,
ooh.
It's almost cliche to say what would have happened if it had been Black people. But the thing is, like,
And we know, because remember the Black Lives Matter protest in D.C. where they called out every federal force available, mm-hmm. including folks from the Bureau of Prisons,
mm-hmm.
All in uniform, riot geared up, thinking about how to deploy kind of weapons that would heat up the skin.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Black people as dangerous.
It just bothers me that Black people shouldn't have to be so noble. Like, you know,
oh, preach.
I mean, like,
right?
It shouldn't just have to be. I mean, white people get called heroic even if they're not necessarily nonviolent. So, you know,
let's take the case. You know, in this book, I talk about Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Who is the white
17-year-old. Very sad story. Yeah. But
17-year-old who crosses state lines with an illegally obtained AR-15, goes to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where there is a protest going on because of the shooting of Jacob Blake 7 times in the back by police. And so there is a protest happening there. And so the cops see this white teenager with this AR-15 and they welcome him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, oh, we really appreciate you guys being here. It's hot out here. You want some water? And then he goes and gets into altercations and he shoots down 3 men, killing 2 of them and seriously wounding a third. He walks back to the cops with his hands up as if to surrender, and the cops go right by him. They don't see threat. Juxtapose that to 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who is the Black child in Cleveland who is playing alone in the park with a toy gun. Now, granted, it doesn't have the orange tip on it that says, hey, I'm a toy, but Ohio is an open carry state. And so it says, as long as you're not pointing the weapon at somebody, you can openly carry it. So there's nobody in the park. He's not threatening anybody. The cops roll up, and within 2 seconds of their arrival, they shoot him down. And the police say, we were afraid. He was threatening. He was dangerous. How is a 12-year-old with a toy gun dangerous and threatening, but a 17-year-old with an AR-15 in the middle of a crowd, not? Anti-Blackness.
Carol, it is always, I don't like that we have so much to talk about when you come on the show, but I do love talking to you.
Oh.
And I can't recommend your book highly enough. It is called The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. Thank you again. Just thank you so much. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, definitely. Thank you so much for having me, Anne-Marie. Thank you.
And that is it for the show. Once again, we were talking to Carol Anderson, author of many, many good books, but most recently, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. I don't have much to add this week, so I'll just say the usual. Everyone out there, you, take care of yourselves.
escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.